glad that you are with us this evening for our 6 p.m. service. The church has an 11 a.m. service every Sunday and a 6 p.m. And tonight is a special service because we have a guest with us. And we're going to talk about him in just a moment. But I also want to acknowledge those who are here this evening who might be a guest to Crossroads. And in your program that you received, there's a connection card. You can go ahead and fill that out later in the service. And we'll be happy to communicate with you and keep you in prayer as you can list your prayer requests on there. And it's a great way to stay connected to the church. Some of you may not even know there was a church here. You may have thought it was a comedy club. Well, at one time it was. But on March the 4th, our Crossroads Church, which just celebrated its 10th anniversary a few weeks ago, we relocated here on March the 4th, and I believe that was strategic in God's plan because our theme from that day forward has been to March 4th for the plans that God has for us. On our anniversary, we shared some of the, plans and the agenda that the church wants to have in this next decade of destiny, a cancer ministry to minister to those. That's why I have some pink on tonight. My traditional pink shirt that I've been wearing every week at church in October, that's being clean right now. But I have this one right here. Real men wear pink, by the way, okay? Now, a portion of every offering this month will go towards the launch of our cancer ministry. And I can't think of a better endeavor for the church of God, the church of Christ, that's called to be the hands of God and the feet of God to love those who are going through that horrific disease. And I think that's a very important ministry. And so we're going to be launching that a little bit later on. But that's why I'm wearing some pink this evening, and I'll be wearing pink for the rest of October. And I encourage you to pray about how you might want to get involved in that ministry, because that will be a big part of the next chapter of our church's history, loving those who walk through that difficult time. I also want to let you know that if you don't have a church home, church is a vital part of your life, and we're glad that you're with us tonight. And maybe before you came in here, you were wondering, if I come in, the roof will fall down. Well, the roof hasn't fallen down yet, okay? And so know that everybody's welcome here to the church. And with that said, I want to tell you this evening, you're in for a treat, because you're going to hear a testimony that perfectly illustrates the unconditional love of God. God doesn't play any favorites. If that was the case, the church would be empty every week. But his love is unconditional, and his mercy actually renews each day of our life, and we thank him for that. And so tonight, we're privileged to have, who's actually no stranger to this church. This is his third time coming. You know, I actually believe this in my heart. Mike isn't a guest here anymore, you know, and Mike's a friend. He's become a part of my family, and we've gotten to know each other over these last 3 years, and so it's a privilege to have him here. Now, at the end of the service, while Mike is actually talking, if you have any questions that you want to have, you're not going to stand up and ask them because you'll be out of order. We don't do that here. But you can actually text me your question. And depending on how the evening goes with time, if we have some time at the end of the service when I come back up, I'll ask Mike some of the questions that you might have during his testimony. And so you can text me that. I'll get that up here on the stage. And then when I come up, if we have time, we'll ask. If not, we'll just pass that through. But you can check out these numbers here. You'll text the number and then text that 37 number as well. And if you can, power your phones to vibrate so we don't have any interruptions during the rest of the evening, because if you send a text, it gets bounced back, it could become annoying, okay? And we don't want that, okay? But again, I want to extend a welcome to each of you here. And now I want to ask you to join me in giving our friend and our brother, Mike Francis, a warm Crossroads welcome. Mike?
Thank you. Thank you very much. And, you know, the way this worked out, and I do consider myself a friend and certainly part of this church, and the way this worked out, I was speaking this afternoon at a church in New Jersey, in Morristown, and knew I was going to be in town, and Ray and I connected, and he asked if I would come here tonight. And I got to tell you, this past April, my mother passed away, and she passed away on Easter Sunday, which was, to me, was a great sign for the, you know, that the Lord said, I got her, don't worry. But I asked Ray to come and speak that night and deliver the message and do the eulogy, and I really have to tell you this. In all my years on this earth, and unfortunately the many, many, many funerals that I've attended throughout my life, I've never, never heard such a gracious, loving, and wonderful message that was given that night for my mom. And not only did he talk about my mom, he really didn't know her. You know, we kind of give him some background, but the way he delivered that message, people that were in the audience that had no idea of Jesus or faith, they were really very, very moved by it. And this man is very gifted, very, very gifted. And I mean that. And anytime I can support him, I will. And I mean that, Ray. You know that. So thank you very much. It really is great to be here. You know, I want to be honest with you. For about 10 years, I avoided coming back to New York at any point in time to give my testimony or really for any other reason. You know, there was a lot of controversy about me, and you know, we all, I think many of you know the story. And so I never wanted to come back here because I didn't want to thumb my nose in anybody's face. I wasn't looking to irritate people. I was just out there doing my thing, and I just felt it wasn't my time. About 4 years ago, a very dear friend of mine who's here, Joe Silva, he got in touch with the agency that represents me and wanted me to bring come into his church in New Jersey. Now, the agency, I instructed them. I said, anytime we get a request from the New York area, don't say no without letting me know. It's my decision. And I always said no, and they always just assumed I would say no because I'm all over the country. And I said no to this one. Then that night I went to sleep, and for some reason, you know, God put it in my heart. I changed my mind. I called up the next day. I said, I'm going to do that church. I didn't know Joe. And they all panicked. What do you mean? You're going back to New York? No, we don't want to do that. I said, no, I'm going to do it. My wife got upset with me. She said, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, and so on and so forth. But I said, look, I want to do it. And I went to Joe's church. I didn't know how I was going to be received. And it went very, very well. It was very encouraging for me. And since then, I've been back on a number of occasions, and people have just been wonderful. I really mean that. So maybe it was part of God's plan for me to come back here. I don't know, but it's been very rewarding. And I will tell you this. I'm going to give you a brief testimony tonight. I will leave time for questions because I think that's what Ray wants to do, and I always enjoy that. And by the way, you can ask me anything you want. I've been asked everything under the sun. You're not going to offend me, and if I don't want to answer, I know how to take the fifth. I've done that many times in my life, so don't worry about it. Fire away. But I'm going to give you a brief testimony. I want to be really clear on this. I'm not here to try to turn anybody into a Christian. I'm not here to impose my faith on you. It's not what I do. And I'm not here to try to prove to you that I'm some kind of a holy roller. Why? Because I'm not. I'm really not. Okay, I'm a normal guy who's probably the most blessed, most fortunate person to ever come up on this stage and address you about anything. Because had I been left up to my own to do what I wanted to do in my life, follow the path that I was on, I'd either be dead or in prison for the rest of my life. And quite honestly, it's what I deserve. It's what I earned, having spent almost 20 years on the street every day in violation of not only God's laws, but the laws of man. It was the life I was in. And I did it knowingly, willingly. I don't blame anybody. I made a choice to come into that life, and I did what I did. And I realized, people, that if God didn't have a different plan and a purpose for my life, I wouldn't be here today. And he's made that crystal clear for me over the years, because this was not my choice. This is not, I said one day, oh, I'm going to, you know, become a good Christian man and go out there and try to change the world. It's not what it's about. And I think as Christians, we are obligated to share what the Lord has done in our lives. And I think that is an obligation. That was the Lord's command to us. Go out and preach the good word to all of creation. So it's not about me up here, people. I'm not wanting you to look at me and say, wow, what a great thing you did. Because like I said, I was dragged along by this. And I was very, very fortunate, very, very blessed. And I realized that if God didn't have this different plan and purpose for my life, I wouldn't be here. And I believe my purpose now is to really be an encouragement to all of you. And why do I say that? I travel this country quite a bit. I'm in a different city every weekend, and I'm in front of thousands of people on a monthly basis. God has really honored this ministry and other things that I do. I speak for Major League Baseball, the NBA. I visited over 400 universities. I work with the NCAA. I do corporate events. I'm all over the place, and I'm in front of people all the time. And I will tell you this, in the past 2 years, I have never seen the amount of despair and discouragement in the hearts and minds of people as I have now. We're going through some tough times in this country. We really are struggling. And I will tell you this, okay, you can hear it from me. We're not living in our grandfather's America anymore. Things are not going to get that much easier regardless of who gets into office. There's a big job to be done, and I don't know if anybody can accomplish it, really. We don't know what track we're on, okay? Things are tough. Not too long ago, I was in a city in the Midwest where the unemployment rate was over 30%. When I was finished, a gentleman came up to me. I was at the book table signing books. He grabbed my arm. He said, "Mr. Francis, I need to speak to you." He said, "I really need to talk to you." And I saw he was struggling. I excused myself. I went on the side with him. I said, "Bro, what's up?" He said, "Mike, I heard everything that you said. And I want to believe God's got a plan and purpose for my life, but you don't understand. I've lost my home in foreclosure." He said, "I've been out of work for over 30 weeks. I can't find a job." He said, "My wife and I have been married over 20 years, but we're starting to have some real problems. People, let's be honest. You don't live on love alone. When economic problems come into the house, they can wreak havoc." He said, "I'm losing control of my teenage kids because I can't provide for them like I once did." He says, "And Mike, I need to confess this to you because I feel horrible about it." He said, "I've been on the internet every day doing some very sinful things just to take my mind off the condition of my life." He said, "How is God going to forgive me? How could he use me? What purpose can I have? I can't even get out of my own way." He was really struggling. Not too long after that, a soldier from Iraq, the same deal, at the book table, got a hold of me. He says, "Mike, I need to talk to you." He said, "You know, I heard what you had to say, but you don't understand." He said, "I've done some horrible things above and beyond my country's call of duty. I have nightmares." He said, "I can't get over this." He said, "You don't quite understand this." And I said, "No, excuse me, brother, I do understand." I said, "A little different circumstances in my life, but I know where you're coming from." And I want to tell all of you tonight what I've told those people and what I tell people all over this country. If God can forgive me, and I really do believe he has. Why? Because I want to be forgiven. He knows my heart. And people, let me tell you this. You saw the DVD. I was pretty good on the street, okay? I could pull a scam on a lot of people. You can't pull a scam on God. He knows our hearts. And if we really are sorry for the sins that we committed, and we ask for forgiveness, okay, we are forgiven. And if we don't believe that, you know what the problem is with that? If we don't believe that God can forgive us no matter what we've done, then we're denying the entire message of the Bible. We're denying the fact that Jesus suffered and died on that cross. And what we're saying is it wasn't good enough to forgive our sins. And that's wrong. We are forgiven. We serve a very gracious God. People ask me all the time, "Mike, are you doing this to make up for the things that you've done in the past?" And my answer is no. Well, I say, why? I said, because I can't make up what I've done in the past. What's done is done. I can't go back and change it. Would I like to? Yeah, but I can't. It's done. But fortunately, we serve a very gracious, loving God. We don't have to make up for it. We've got to ask for forgiveness. And if we are sincere, we are forgiven, past, present, and future. And you need to be encouraged by that. And some people say, "Well, Mike, you know, I've done some horrible things in my life, and I can't get over it. And how is God going to use me? I'm a sinful person. I'm a drug addict. I'm a gambler. I've abused my wife. I don't take care of my kids right. I steal from my boss. All of these things. How is God going to use that?" And you know what I say to them? I say, "Bro, let me ask you something. If God didn't use sinful people and sinful experiences, who would he have to use? We've all fallen short. Am I right?" And I tell a lot of people that come to me struggling with all sorts of things, because I go into prisons too. I say, "Hey, bro, who better to speak to a drug addict than somebody who's been there and done that, now found the Lord, and you can instruct them out the right way?" I said, "You got a lot of credibility. God will use everything in your past, whether it be good or bad. And if you give it up to him, he'll turn it around and use it for his plan and purpose in your life." And you know what? As you sit there, you may not realize this, but I've realized that I'm 60 years old. And I know this. I wasn't put on this earth just to have a family. And I love my family as much as anyone. Been very blessed. And I wasn't put here to have a success in business. And that's important to me. I want to be successful like it is to most of you. But you find out in life that that's not what this life is all about. You don't just do that, and then one day you lay your head on a pillow, and that's it. You close your eyes, and it's over. God has a plan and a purpose for every one of our lives, people. We all have a gift or a talent that he's ready to use. And that's why we're here. And you got to realize that. And it doesn't matter if you realize that at the age of 9 or the age of 99. Whenever you realize it, God will use your past to fulfill a purpose in your future. And that's what it is. And people, you don't have to have a mob story. You don't have to be high profile. You don't have to be famous or infamous. Whatever your purpose is to fulfill, once you do it, we're all on equal footing. Am I right, Ray? That's it. So my job is to encourage you tonight, because I want you to understand this. If God can forgive me, and like I said, I believe he has. And not only forgive me, but give me my life, give me my freedom, a wife that I adore, children that I love, a ministry that I never asked for. I ran from this. I never expected this. But if he can do all of this for me, then he can and we'll do the same for you. You just got to know when to give it up. My wife says, Mike, you're a miracle. I'm not a miracle. Now, she can say that because she's been through everything with me. You know, she's a miracle that you're here, but I'm not a miracle, people. Now, do I ever believe in miracles? Sure, I do. I believe childbirth is a miracle. I got 7 kids, so I can say that, okay? Childbirth is a miracle. Sometimes we take it for granted, but it's a miracle. Okay, how this comes about. I believe when a terminally ill person goes to the doctor, he's gone. The doctor says, hey, you know what? Tie up your loose ends, man. You don't have much time. And he goes home, and the people that love him pray for him. He goes back the next time. Miraculously, he's cured. That's a miracle. What happened with me? I just became obedient at some point in time and said, God, I'm giving control to you. And he navigated this course for me for where I am today. That's it. So that's what it takes. It doesn't take a miracle. It takes obedience. You give it up, and you're obedient. And giving it up was tough for me. I was a control freak, okay? But at some point in time, God brought me to my knees, and that's the decision I made. So with that, I'm going to kind of get through my story a little bit more quick so we do have time for questions. It is a mob story. That's where I came from. But hopefully you see where God interceded in my life, and you get what the message is. And people, listen, okay? This isn't about me. Whenever you hear a speaker up here speaking to you about anything, the deal is, how do you apply it to your life? What's going on in your life? If God did this in this guy's life, what is he doing for me? That's what it's all about. Because like I said, we're just sharing what the Lord has done to let you see that he can do it for you too. So that's the important thing. And I do hope, selfishly, you walk out of here a little bit differently than you walked in. Because I know God's going to plant the seed. And I know some of you are going to be immediately impacted. You're going to say, Mike, I was the one person God needed to speak to today. I got the message. And some of you are going to say, you know what, pretty good story. I don't know too much about this guy. You know, I don't know. I'm not convinced. And you're going to walk out of here, and you're going to go about your life. But I'll tell you this. It has nothing to do with me. A seed will be planted in your heart tonight, no doubt about it. And it may take 20 years before God waters the seed that's planted in your heart. But you know what? Once God's got a hold of your heart, people, he will never let you go. So you may as well make it easy on yourself. Start tonight. My dad was the underboss of the Colombo family back in the 60s, one of the 5 New York La Cosa Nostra families. You know, it's funny. When I come back here, I don't have to say too much. When I go out to the Midwest, I got to give them like a mob 101. They don't know what's happening out there. I always say back here, I got to make sure there's nobody in the audience that's still mad at me because that could be hanging around. But anyway, you know the deal here, which is good. I don't have to get into too much. But and you probably know who my dad was, Sonny Francis. You know, his name was all over the place. And he was the underboss back in the 60s and a very powerful position in that life. And, you know, I loved my dad growing up as a kid. I really did. I idolized him. He was a great father, great husband to my mother. Really loved his kids very, very much. And I wanted to do everything to please him. And he was very supportive of me as a kid growing up. He didn't want this life for me. He wanted me to go to school and be a doctor. Son, stay off the street, get an education. That's where it's at. And he was so supportive of me. I got to tell you a story. When I was a kid, I played all 3 sports in school. I was kind of a jock. And my dad would never miss a game. Randall, no matter what he was doing, I'd be playing ball, he would show up. My business, legit business, I don't know what he was doing, but he'd show up. I never forget, I'd be playing baseball, and I'd be up to bat, and I'd look out of the corner of my eye. It happened so often, here comes Dad. He'd drive up in a big black Cadillac or a black Lincoln. For those of you my age, remember those 1960 Cadillacs? Their fin was half the size of this room. You couldn't miss them, right? And he'd pull right up to the field. He never went to the parking lot, right up to the field, right? He gets out of the car, always dressed sharp in a suit. Dad never dressed any other way. He always had 5 or 6 guys with him. He'd never travel alone. They'd get out of the car, start walking onto the field, into the stands. The umpire take one look at that crew. Never call strike 3 on me when he seen Dad. I used to say, hey, Dad, you're very good for my batting average. I played football. Nobody would tackle me when he was in the stands. Good to have a dad in the mob when you play sports. And he was great, and he got in some real trouble back in the 60s. Indicted several times, a couple of times in the state for some serious crimes. Went to trial, beat all those cases. But then in 1966, he was indicted in federal court for masterminding a nationwide string of bank robberies, him and 4 other guys. After a lengthy trial, he was convicted. In 1967, he was sentenced to 50 years in prison. In 1970, after he lost all his appeals, he was shipped off to Leavenworth Penitentiary to do his time in Kansas. I was a pre-med student, Hofstra University, when Dad went in. I was devastated. He was 50 when he went in. Figured he had 50 on top of that, he'd never come out of prison alive. Just as an aside, my dad today, he's 95 years old. He's done 35 years in prison thereabouts since 1970, in and out five times, each time on a parole violation, and each time for associating with another felon or somebody alleged to be an organized crime. You can't do that when you're on federal parole. When I was on parole, I had 526 people on my separation list. They actually give you a list. Some of the guys I never heard of. Some of them were dead. They don't even let you go to a cemetery and meet with anybody. The feds are tough. And my dad had a real problem with that. He would come out, you know, meet with somebody, and I understood he had to do his thing, but they'd be surveilling him. They'd catch him, violate him, goes back in. Five times. About 3 or 4 years ago, he was in a pen in Milan, Michigan, and I went to see him. I said, "Dad, come on, man. You're getting too old for this. You got to stop meeting people." He said, "Son, what do you want me to do? I don't know anybody that's not a felon." He said, "Even you're a felon." I said, "I know that, Dad. You're allowed to see me." And so I was number one on his separation list. Took me a long time to get off. But anyway, he straightened that out. But, you know, the sad thing, for those of you who probably know, is a big case. My dad got out on the last violation, and within a short period of time, he was indicted again on another racketeering case, went to trial with a few other gentlemen, and after a lengthy trial, he was convicted and sentenced to another 8 years in prison. And his release date now is 2017. He's got to live to be 100 to get out on this one. You know what? He's in pretty good shape for 95, but, you know, he's still 95, and we got to pray for him, and hopefully he makes it through this one. But I'll tell you what, day he got sentenced back in 1967, stood in front of Judge Mishley, Eastern District of New York. The judge said to him, "I just sentenced you to 50 years. You got anything to say, Mr. Francis?" He said, "Yes, Your Honor, I'm going to fool you and everybody else. I'm going to do the whole 50, okay?" And I got to tell you something, everybody in the case is dead except him. I said, "Dad, you keep your promise." He said, "Darn right, I ain't dying until at least 2017. I made a promise to the judge." That's my dad. Trust me. He gives you his word. That's it. But I want you to pray for my dad, really. Keep him in prayer. He's a great guy. He really is. And I know it's tough to say. You know, sometimes you think different things. But he loved his family very much, loved his kids, and pray for him. Really, keep him in prayer. And I go to see my dad in Leavenworth. Oh, no. Prior to that, I kind of lost interest in school a little bit. Joe Colombo was the boss of our family at that time. He and a couple other guys kind of took me under their wing. I started to meet a lot of my dad's friends. I said, "Mike, what are you doing going to school? If you don't get on the street and help your old man out, he's going to die in prison." And I was very affected by that because, people, I want to tell you this. My dad did a lot of rough things in his life. He spent a lot of time in that life. So did I. I went to jail for a crime that I was guilty of. I pled guilty and went to jail. I said, but that particular crime that my dad has done all of this time for, he was innocent of. No doubt about it. My dad was not a bank robber. I investigated that case thoroughly. We spoke to every witness. They recanted their testimony later. We tried to get it overturned. We couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. My dad was no bank robber. He's in jail all this time for a crime that he didn't commit. But you know what? You put your hand in the fire long enough, unfortunately, in this life, you're going to get burnt. The system is not always fair. It's just the way it is. So I tell people all the time, you want to get it, you got to stay away from it. That's it. And, you know, something I didn't mention, I want you to understand, I grew up really hating the police, hated the government, and hated law enforcement because I loved my dad so much, and I saw them as the enemy. I really did. And it was a kind of a distorted way of thinking, but that's how we grow up. I don't feel that way anymore, people. God has been able to not only transform my heart, but really transform my mind. And I realized one thing in life. You can't beat law enforcement in this country anymore. You go that route, you're going down. They're too sophisticated. They got too many weapons. You just can't beat them. You can't. And today I got many friends in law enforcement, and not because I share information, because they're friends. Chief of Police of Beverly Hills, a brother in Christ, a dear friend of mine. Who would have thought, right? But and I want to tell you this. For all the young people in this audience, I can't really see with the lights, but I don't know if you're there. But I want to tell you this. I deliver a very strong anti-crime message to kids all over this country. I'm in detention centers. I go to high school, colleges, middle school, the whole bit. I happen to have a heart for children, seven of my own. And I do believe that these young people today have more negative influences at their fingertips than we ever had as kids growing up. And we got to get them the right message and put them in the right direction. And, you know, when I tell them straight out, especially these gangbangers, fortunately, you know, I can communicate with them pretty good, pretty solid. And I've done a lot around here in this area. But I will tell you this. The best message you can give these young ones today is to tell them this. You are who you hang with in this life. You hang with the wrong crowd. I don't care if you come to church every Sunday, got the greatest parents, go to the best school, drive the best car, you're going to be known to be the wrong person. You must surround yourself with the right people in this life. It's very, very important. If I didn't do that at some point in time, I wouldn't be here today. I just got very fortunate that people cared about me and put me in the right direction. Okay? So if I do come here and speak at your school, the school parents, don't worry. I give the kids the right message because that's what I believe. And so I start to lose interest in school. I go see my dad in Leavenworth. I said, Dad, I'm not going to school anymore. If I don't get on the street and help you out, you're going to die in here. He was upset. Didn't want it for me. We kind of argued in the visiting room. And he was upset. I remember him just really, oh, I didn't want you. I want you to be professional, so on and so forth. Your mother's going to be upset with me, the whole bit. I said, Dad, I made up my mind. And I was pretty headstrong as a kid. And I remember him just kind of throwing his hands up, and he said, all right, son, but if you're going to be on the street, I want you on the street the right way. And in his mind, the right way was to become a member of his life. He said, go home. Somebody's going to be in touch with you. Do whatever you're told. And that was it. My dad gave me no further instruction. Okay? That was it. He just figured I had it in me. He knew what he was doing. Go home. On the job training. Because, you know, in that life, you're not supposed to speak about the life with anybody outside of it. My dad, if anything, he's a good soldier. He wouldn't violate that policy, even with me, his own son. And for me, I didn't question my dad. I loved him so much, I was ready to do anything he wanted me to do. I didn't question. I said, wait a second, Dad, you know, explain things to me. I mean, of course, I lived and I saw, but he never sat down and had a conversation with me. My dad was so great, he never brought any issues outside of the house into the house. When he came in the house, he could have had the worst day in the world. When he came in the house, everything was great. That's how he treated our family. I'll never forget that, and I love him for that. But I never questioned him. I had blind faith in what my father asked me to do. And, you know, remember that, blind faith. How often have you heard that Christians are supposed to have blind faith? Don't ever challenge God. Don't question him. He'll be angry with you. He's God. Well, I'll tell you something. I don't believe that. When I finally came to Christ and I had this relationship that I developed with Jesus, and if I wasn't giving my testimony, I would talk to you the rest of the night about having a relationship with Jesus. Because you know what, people? That's what this life is all about. And you can have a relationship with Jesus the same way you can have with the person sitting next to you. It's not a coincidence that there's more information about this man than there was for any million men that ever walked the face of the earth. He said everybody will have an opportunity to know me. And once you get to know him, he does come alive in your heart, and you will see the difference. And some of you know what I'm talking about. For those of you that don't, you're going to give yourself an opportunity to do that. And when I finally did have this relationship with him, I started to look back in my life, and I said, you know what, God? Now I get it. Now I know why you put this person in my life. Now I know why you allowed me to have this great joy, why I had this struggle, this grief. You're using everything to prepare me for what your purpose is for me now. And think about it. Who's the person that dragged you into this church tonight? For some of you guys that didn't want to come here, you figure, hey, the Sopranos is off the air. Let me see what the real guy is all about, right? You're not here for any other reason. But somebody brought you in here tonight. Okay? God is always trying to get your attention. And I look back at this meeting and I said, this was really significant. You know why? Of course, because my dad was proposing me into that lifestyle. But more than that, because I did have blind faith. And when I finally did come to Christ, I couldn't do it again. I said, no, God, wait a second. Okay, people are telling me that this Bible is the blueprint for my life. Remember that, people. That Bible is written by men, but inspired by God, and it is the blueprint for our life. That's what we believe as Christians. And you take it a step further. In our faith, the only way to get to heaven is through Jesus Christ. In our faith, in any faith, the only way to get to heaven is Jesus Christ. No gray area, black and white, Jesus or nothing. Well, think about it. God is asking a lot of you. Because I said to him, hey, God, you put me on this earth. You gave me a free will. I can choose any one of 100 faiths, or I don't have to choose any faith at all. And you're telling me this is the only way? No, God, I'm not buying into it that easy. I trusted my father once more than anything. And look where it got me. And it got me in a bad place. I'll get to that. Take it a step further in my life. I took a blood oath. I swore to a La Cosa Nostra. I did it twice in my life, God, and it got me in a real bad place. I can't do this a third time. It's too serious because I believe there's a heaven and I believe there's a hell. And it's too serious for me. If you want me to buy into that, God, you got to prove it to me. You got to show me the evidence. And people, I know a little bit about evidence, okay? It's been a major part of my life. I've been to trial 5 times. I've been to more grand juries than there are people in that section of the room. I've been to more parole hearings between me and my dad and other people that I know than I want to even think about. I know every standard of proof that exists in our criminal justice system. I understand the law, not by choice, but by necessity. Evidence has been a major, major part of my life. I think in terms of evidence. You're not selling me to Brooklyn Bridge. You grow up on the street a little bit, you become a little cynical. You want to know, hey, show me. I'm not buying into that. And I want to tell you this, people, and I mean this with all my heart. When I finally opened up my heart and my mind and said, God, show me, I found out that there is more evidence, rock-solid evidence, to prove that the Bible is truly God's Word and that Jesus is our risen Savior than there is for anything else that exists in the world. Amen? Amen. And you know what? That's why I can come up here and speak to you passionately about it, because this is what I believe with all my heart. Not imposing it on you, but this is what I believe. I believe it with all my heart, people. It's based upon evidence. And some of you say, well, don't you have to have faith, Michael? Well, sure, you got to have faith. But, you know, we look at faith as some otherworldly thing, like, oh, you got to have faith, like it only applies to God. Let me ask you this. Do you know how much faith you have in your everyday life? How much faith do you have every time you get in an airplane? Think about it. You walk into that plane, you have zero control of your life. That's it. You put your life in the hands of the pilot and the equipment and the FAA, which scares me because the government doesn't run things that well, okay? But no, seriously. But what is your faith based upon? Pretty solid evidence. The plane is in good hands. The pilot knows what he's doing. The FAA's got it under control. The track record is excellent. But you have faith, but it's based upon evidence. It's the same thing with God. He doesn't ask you to just accept things blindly. He wants you to open up your heart and your mind, because he knows if you're ready to do that, he's ready to show you the proof. I do men's groups all the time, and they always say, oh, Mike, show me. And then they don't want to look. You got to do the work, man. It's like anything else. And Ray laid this out beautifully when he gave my mother's eulogy that night. It's based upon, okay, the work. You got to do the search. It's there. And once you do that, I bet you, you'll walk out of here saying, you know what? Now I get it. Now I understand it. It's there. And people say to me, well, what happens if you're wrong, Michael? I'll tell you what happens if I'm wrong. Okay? I'm a New Testament guy. I know my Bible, but I love the New Testament. You know, when I came to Christ, I looked at Jesus and I said, you know what? Before I'm ready to follow this guy, I have to separate his manhood from his deity. Why? Because I grew up my whole life. I heard my whole life, Michael, you got to be a man's man. That's the standard that you have to live up to. My father preached that to me. I heard it from the day I could remember. A man's man. When I got into the life, a man's man. I heard that so many times. The guys would say it on the street. So who did I look up to? I wanted to emulate my father. He was a man's man. Sonny Francis, Fat Tony Salerno, a guy that I really admired. Even Paulie Castellano, I knew Paulie well, I admired him. These guys had strength, they had integrity, character. I looked up to these guys, they were men's men. So when I came to Jesus, I naturally separated his manhood from his deity. I said, I want to see what type of man this guy is. And people, I was blown away by the character, integrity, courage, humility, and I could go on and on all night, that Jesus displayed in the Gospels. So here's what happens if I'm wrong. If I emulate Jesus and try to be that type of a man's man, of course I can never get there, but if that's who I aspire to be, here's what happens. I become a better husband. I become a better father. I become a better person in the community. I become more courageous. I become more humble. I have more integrity, more character. And if everybody around me is going to benefit by me because I'm a better person. And you know what happens if I'm wrong? When I die, I'm dead anyway. So what did I lose? I gained everything and so did everybody else. But you know what? I know I'm right, because we serve a God that's living, and I know I'm right. The evidence is there. Nobody could ever, you know, it's funny. When you give that argument to people, you see, Ray, nobody could ever argue with you. They can't argue about the manhood of Jesus. You know what they do at that point? Well, how do you know the Bible is real? Then they go back to that. They can't argue about Jesus as it is written in the Gospels. Remember that. It's a powerful argument. Very powerful. So, I leave there that day. About 2 weeks later, a captain and a family picked me up, took me to see the boss. Joe Colombo had been shot, as you know, seriously wounded, eventually died from the wounds. A new boss took over. His name was Tom DiBella. Tom has passed on. Now I sat with Tom. He said, Mike, I got a message from your father. He said, you want to become a member of our life. Is that true? I said, yes. He said, here's the deal. From now on, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're on call to serve this family. That means if your mother is sick and dying and this family calls you to service and you're at her side, you leave your mother and you come and serve us. From now on, we're number one in your life before anything and everything. When and if we feel you deserve this privilege, this honor to become a member, we'll let you know. I was 22 years old. I was in kind of like a pledge period where I had to do anything and everything I was told to do to prove myself worthy. Could have been something very menial. A lot of discipline in that life, a lot of alleged respect, a lot of authority. You had a meeting at 8 o'clock. You didn't get there at 7:30. You were late. Big time trouble. You don't do that. Never late. Can't be late in that life. You drive the boss to a meeting, sit in the car. I remember one time I sat outside of Junior's Deli waiting for Tom and Andrew Russo to come back out. I'm in there 4 hours. I had to go to the restroom, right? I get out of the car to go to the restroom. Just my luck, they happen to come out to go in the car. I'm not there. My gosh, you would have thought what I did. What if something happened? You weren't here. How do you leave your post? Oh, I'm sorry. I was really put on a shelf for a while for doing that. But stuff like that, you know, a lot of things like that, kind of learn the business of the street a little bit. And people, I want to be honest with you because you need to understand. This is very difficult for me to say. Understand this. But you need to understand what God has done in my life. Not what I did, but what God has done. That life at times is very violent. And if you're part of the life, you're part of the violence, and there's no escape. And you're around here, you understand what the deal is. And I only say that to you to be an encouragement for those of you who think that God can't forgive. If you think anything out of this tonight, and you say, wow, God was able to do something in that guy's life, then be encouraged in your own. I guess about a year later, I proved myself worthy. Halloween night, 1975, my anniversary is coming up in the next week or so. Myself and five other guys were called into a room. That night, we all took an oath and became sworn, made members of the Colombo family. I took that oath very seriously back then, people. I take it seriously today, even though I don't consider myself a member of that life anymore. You come into the life, you don't sign a contract, there's no retirement age, you know the deal, you can't say, hey, I'm done. They say when you leave that life, you either leave in a coffin or you join the government and enter a witness protection program. Obviously, I've done neither at this point in time. Very solemn ceremony, meant to be very imposing. You're made to understand the seriousness of what you're getting involved in. Dimly lit room late at night. We walked into the room individually. The six of us did. The boss was seated at the head of like a horseshoe configuration, the underboss and the consigliere to his left and right. All the captains were alongside of them. Walked down the aisle, stood in front of the boss, held out my hand, took a knife, cut my finger. Some blood dropped on the floor. This is a blood oath. I cupped my hands. Took a picture of a saint, Catholic altar card, put it in my hands and lit it aflame. Didn't hurt, it burnt quickly, it was merely symbolic. And he said something to me that night that I don't recall ever hearing in my life before. And I grew up as a Catholic. Went to Catholic school from kindergarten right through high school. I was an altar boy the whole bit. But for some reason, for me, Catholicism was like a subject in school. I didn't understand that the life was about a relationship with Jesus. And I'm not blaming Catholics, it just didn't work for me. And when he said this that night, it was the first time I heard it. He said, tonight, Michael Francis, you are born again into a new life, into La Cosa Nostra. Violate what you know about this life, betray your brothers, and you will die and burn in hell like the saint is burning in your hands. He said, do you accept? And I said, yes, I do. Think of the irony of that. You know, people, the enemy is out there trying to mock our Lord all the time. And he turns born again, what we know to be born again, into born again for his purposes. And you know, it was funny. I didn't tell you this, Ray. I was doing Pastor Jonathan. It was a temple, a messianic temple here in Brooklyn. It was in New Jersey. And after I said this, I walked off the stage, and some guy walked up to me like horrified, and he put his hands on my shoulder, and he says, Michael, when you said that, I had a vision of Satan standing behind you saying to God, I got one of yours. And I said, man, I said this 1,000 times, but you're scaring me now. Take it easy. Don't go any further like that. He really got to me. But just think about it. And I left there that night. I went in. The other five guys went in. They all took the oath. You come into the life, you come in as a soldier. I was motivated to do two things. I wanted to get my dad out of prison, told you about that, and I wanted to make money. My dad said, in this life, you make money, it translates to power, not unlike the real world. I was very aggressive, very, very motivated. You saw the DVD. No need to get into that. I was fortunate in that I knew how to use that life to benefit me in business, went on to make a lot of money. 1980, boss of my family, you're doing a great job, Mike. I'm going to make you a cop regime. And from 1980 until about really 94, 95, when for me the split was really final, I kind of operated in that capacity. And I want to tell you where I was in 1984 when I think God started to make a change in my life. 1984, okay? I'm a cop regime in the family. Who knows what would have happened? They were looking to make me. My dad was hoping that maybe one day I would really get high up in there, and he was kind of pushing me in that direction. And I became a major target of law enforcement. I got indicted 5 times. I went to trial 5 times. I beat every case. I beat Rudy Giuliani in 84. I was one of the first major mob guys he indicted under the RICO statute, me and Jimmy Rotunda. And I was a lead defendant. I had 15 co-defendants. I'll never forget the day of my arraignment. We were getting bail, and we were in the courtroom, and Rudy walked by my table, and he said to me, Francis, if I convict you on this, you're getting double what your father got. I'm going to give you 100 years. And that's the kind of time that were given us in the 80s. And I never forget, I looked at him and I said, hey, Rudy, bring it on. Beat you guys 4 times already. Let's go for round 5. And that was a dumb thing to do. You don't ever antagonize them any more than any, but they don't need any incentive to come after you. They already got it, trust me. But I was arrogant, didn't like the cops, you know. So, but fortunately, after a very lengthy trial, I was acquitted in that case. Some of my co-defendants were convicted, and they got 30 years. If I lose that case, I'm not here today. I would have gotten at least 50. So I beat that case. I'll be honest with you, I'm doing pretty good. I'm bringing in $8, $9 million a week into my operation. We were in the gas business, you probably know about. We devised a scheme to take the taxes out of the gallon of every gallon of gasoline. It turned out to be a tremendous deal, a lot of money. And so we're making a lot of money. And I have my own jet plane, my own helicopter. I had a house in Florida, a house in Long Island, a house in Marina Del Rey, California. And I had 300 guys under me. I organized all the Russians in Brighton Beach. They were in the gas business with me. So I had it going on, honestly, the age of 31. Top of the world, Ma. Got it going on. Beat all of these cases. Got all the money I need, okay? Moving up in the ranks in that family. I had it going on. Now, did I believe in God back then? Sure I did. Why? It makes sense to believe in God, people. When I look around this world and I see here, okay, it makes sense. Intelligent design makes sense. Creation makes sense. Now, can I understand how God has always been there, always was, always will be, always remains the same? No, that's beyond my human capacity, but it makes more sense to me to believe in intelligent design. I don't believe in evolution. I don't think I got anything in common with a snail or a crocodile or a peacock or a penguin, okay? And answer me this. Answer me this, please, outside, whenever. If you can explain this to me, okay. If I evolved from an ape, why are apes still here? Did some apes decide to be human and some said, no, I like it as an ape? I don't get it. I believe, people, evolution doesn't make sense. I believe one day it's going to be proven to be one of the biggest jokes ever played on mankind. It doesn't make sense. Intelligent design makes sense. God makes sense. But did I have a relationship with him? No. He was doing his thing. I was doing mine. Then something happened. Among many things I was doing back then, I was making movies. I had a production company out in L.A., and I was banging out these movies. And a good friend of mine, Smokey Robinson, and Leon Isaac Kennedy at the time, they came to me. They had a screenplay for a breakdance movie. And they said, Mike, we want you to make this movie. A lot of music, a lot of dance, a lot of rap music. But that's when you can listen to rap music on a radio. Not like today. Forget about this stuff today. But back then, it was cool. We had the Sugar Hill Gang, okay, Curtis Blow, Run DMC, the Fat Boys, old school rap. I liked that. They were all in the movie. I said, all right, Smokey, I'll make the film if we can film it in Florida. I got a house down there. I like the warm weather. Let's do that. He said, okay. So we're going to make this movie in Florida. And I bring cast and crew from L.A. to work in the film to Florida. And I bring about 50 dancers, professional dancers. I got everybody staying in the Marina Bay Club in Fort Lauderdale. It's a big hotel down there. And we were in pre-production for a couple of weeks. And we were getting ready to go into production. And one day we were all just chilling, taking it easy, sitting by the pool, mind our own business. Beautiful day in Florida, I'll never forget. And I'm by the pool hanging. I had a couple of guys from Brooklyn down there. We're just shooting a breeze. And guys, you'll appreciate this. I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, out of the water comes this gorgeous 20-year-old girl. I saw her. I'm not kidding. Everything went in slow motion. It was like a Pepsi commercial for me, right? I'm totally focused on her. I said, man, who is this girl? It's beautiful, right? And she looked like a dancer. She had like a dancer's body to me. So I tell the choreographer, he was sitting next to me. I said, hey, Jeff, is that one of your girls? He said, yeah. I said, what's her name? He said, Camille. I said, well, bring her over. I want to meet her. I figured, Big Shot producer, she'll want to meet me. Why not, right? So she comes over. I introduce myself to her. I said, Camille, I'm your producer. I want to get to know you better. I want to take you to lunch one day. She says, sure. Very sweet, polite, gorgeous face, right? So we set a time and a place. I set up one of the restaurants on top of one of the major hotels in Miami. I got everything set. I already bought the violins that day. I figure, no problem. I sweep her off her feet. She's mine. I go up there. 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes later, she stood me up. Stood up a mob guy, imagine that, but she didn't know who I was. Anyway, thank God, she would have never showed up. But I see her the next day, I said, hey, what happened? We had a date, you didn't show up. She doesn't make an excuse. Now, that impressed me. She just looked at me and smiled, and so I had to make myself feel better. I make an excuse for her. I said, well, were you dancing? You know, you rehearsing? Say something. She said, I was rehearsing. I said, let's try it again. We set another time and a place I go. She stood me up again. Now, she did this to me 5 times. I'm not kidding. Now, if she was sitting here, she would say, would you stop exaggerating? It wasn't 5 times. You roll her eyes. It's no, excuse me. I was the offended party. I wasn't used to rejection back then. It was 5 times. Guys, we know when we're rejected, right? She won't have anything to do with me. But I'm watching her on a set. You know, I'm just keeping my eye on her. One night, we're having a cast meeting. I see her coming out of the meeting. It's about 9:30. She's upset. Something is wrong. She's with her friends. I said, oh, That's it. Tailor-made for me. If I got to get rid of somebody, fire somebody, whatever the problem is, I'm going to solve it. I'm in, right? I go and see her. She finally starts to talk to me. I said, what's wrong? She said, you know, Mike, I really need to go home. I said, why? What's the problem? She was from Anaheim, California. She used to dance in Disney and Knott's Berry Farm. She had no clue what she was doing with me. And I said, well, what's wrong? She said, well, you know, my mom and dad want me to come home. She's only 20. She said, I've never been away from home this long. There's some things happening on this movie set that I don't agree with. Those sets can get kind of wild. Music, dancing, young kids, you know, a lot of partying going on. But I'm saying to her, myself, rather, I said, well, you're a dancer. What's the big deal? You know, what's the problem? But then I start to realize, we used to go to some of the clubs and all that. She would never come. One or two friends, hang out, back to the room. That was it. Kept to herself. So I said to her, what's the problem, you know? She says, well, you know, I'm a person of faith or a believer. I don't forget, remember, a Christian, whatever she said. Well, you know, I'm Catholic. We got something in common. Let's talk, right? Anything to get to know her better. Long story short, cut to the chase, I fell very much in love with this young woman, and she's now my wife of 28 years. And thank you. And there's no doubt, people, that she was the catalyst that God used to lead me to the Lord. And the reason I say catalyst, somebody can lead you to the Lord. Nobody can make you accept him. That's very personal. It's between you and God. But we start to get together a little bit on a set. She starts to like me. We wrap the movie. She says, Mike, I got to go, but listen, if you want to continue this, you got to come and meet my mother. I say, I'm good with moms. Let's go, right? So we get on a plane, and we head out to L.A. I meet her mom, Irma. Her mom, Irma, was the most godly woman I ever met in my life. I'm not kidding. You meet Irma for 5 minutes, your name goes in her prayer book. She had a prayer book like a telephone book. I never seen that before, like a telephone book. And the entries in the book, I'm not kidding. The guy I saw on the corner with one shoe, the delivery boy that came to the house, she didn't need to know your name. If she thought you needed prayer, you were in the book, and she faithfully prayed for you, right? So I'm seeing this woman, and I'm seeing Camille. Camille is a 20-year-old dancer, you know, and that, but I saw that they really loved the Lord. They really loved the Lord. He meant something in their life. As a matter of fact, they would talk sometimes like he was standing next to us. It was kind of spooky for me at the time, like Jesus is around here. I don't belong here, right? But I'm starting to fall in love with this girl, and I'm starting to see that this really means something to them. Now, here's what's happening. I'm saying, selfishly, I want this girl in my life. You know, women have a part. We never know what God's going to use to get our attention. With me, I happen to be a beautiful woman, right? So I said, I really want her in my life, but my life is a direct contradiction to everything these people believe. How is this going to work? Now, I want to tell you the amazing thing for me, people. I told you where I was when I met her for one reason. I was at the top of my game when I met this girl. I'm going all the way. I'm mob guy. I'm my father's son. I'm in love with the Lord. I'm there all the way. It was never on my radar screen, I kid you not, ever to walk away from that life. It wasn't even a thought in my mind. But now I'm meeting this girl. I'm falling in love with her, and all of a sudden, my love for her is becoming more powerful than this lifelong bond I had with my dad, more powerful than this blood oath that I took to La Cosa Nostra. Now, how do you explain that? I'm going to be honest. She wasn't the first beautiful woman I met in my life. But you know what the difference was? Now I know, 29 years later, it was God. No doubt. He put her in my life. And so now I'm starting to think, okay, I want to be with her. Very selfish, and I want to be honest with you, it wasn't any noble thing, okay? I wasn't buying into her faith. I didn't care if she was Buddhist, Islam, I didn't care what she was. I'm in love with a beautiful woman. I respected her belief, and I realized it wasn't going to work, but I wasn't buying into it. That was it, okay? But I said, I got a plan. Always had a plan, right? I said, they're going to indict me in the Eastern District of New York, another case, this whole gasoline case. I get a hold of my lawyer, John Jacobs. He's passed away now. I said, John, I beat the government so many times, I'm throwing in a towel. I want to take a plea. He said, what do you mean? I said, I want to take a plea. I beat him. Let me do a couple of years in prison. I said, I'll give him some money. This was my plan. I figured I'd marry Camille. I'd move out to the West Coast. When I get out of jail, I'll have parole and probation. I got an excuse. Guys in New York, they know I can't come and meet with them. I said, maybe after 10 or 12 years, I'm saying to myself, they'll forget about me. I'll live happily ever after with Camille out on the West Coast. I said, I can do that. That was my plan. It wasn't any great, wonderful thing that I was doing. I wasn't doing it for moral reasons, like this is a bad life. And let me tell you something, people. Do I believe that life is an evil life? Yes, I do. Why? Because not the guys are evil. I will not call these guys evil. I was one of them. And I'm not the pot calling the kettle black. I just happen to be blessed and saved. Okay? I would never say that about anybody in our life, but I will tell you this. It is an evil life. Why? Because I don't know any family of any member of that life, including my own, not my wife and kids, praise God, but my brothers and sisters and mother, that haven't been totally devastated. I don't mean hurt. I mean devastated. And you look in the ranks, and it's the same thing all over. And any life that does that to a family is a bad life. That's it. And we don't get it when we're in there, and I understand the whole thing, but it really is. It's part of the issues that I had with my dad. I said, Dad, you don't get it. I said, this life caused all of this to our family. My dad sometimes don't take responsibility because he says, Mike, son, I was in jail all of this time. I said, Dad, exactly. I said, I understand, and you were framed and all that, but it's the life. It's not you personally. It's the life. Okay? But I lost my place. Where was I? Help me, Ray. what happened? Oh, anyway, so it wasn't any noble reason. So we're going to take a plea, okay? I do take a plea. 10-year prison sentence, $15 million restitution, $5 million in forfeitures. I gave up the plane, the helicopter, the whole bit. Figure I'll marry this girl. Boom, move out to the West Coast. I tell Camille, can you handle me doing a couple of years in prison? You know what that girl said to me at 21? She says, Michael, I'd rather have you alive in prison, okay, than with all these problems you say you have on the street. She said, God will be in the foundation of our marriage. We will make it somehow. And I want to tell you this. I'm really not the story here. I brought so much baggage into this girl's life, she didn't have a clue. I got to be honest with you. She didn't realize what she was getting into. And she'll tell you, I love my husband, but if God wasn't there, we wouldn't have made it. Too tough, too much stuff that we had to go through and what she had to go through, what I brought to the marriage. Now, of course, I loved her, but, you know, love is difficult when you're bringing all this other stuff in. So I marry Camille in July. I go off to prison in December. While I'm in there, something occurs where I basically, well, first something happens. Life magazine is bothering the warden. I want to do a story on Franzese. 25 years earlier, they had done the biggest story they ever did in life on my dad. And so they were doing this story on me now. And I said, all right, let me talk to the guy. I'm always trying to maneuver. I figure, you know, I'll make it a better story because I don't need the headache when I get out. And I'm trying to ease things with the government. I'm trying to make my life right. So he comes in. He's questioning me. I say, hey, what are you talking about? There is no mob. I tell him standard mob stuff. I married this girl. I'm moving out to the West Coast. I like the warm weather. Leave me alone, right? And I leave. 2 weeks later, the warden calls me back into the office. He says, Franzese, I thought you were a smart guy. I says, why? He said, do you have a death wish? I said, what are you talking about? And he shows me the article. Bad article. It was like 10 pages long, big double opening with a big picture of me smiling and across the top, quitting the mafia. And I'm in jail with a bunch of guys, and I start reading the story. I said, oh, my gosh, this guy had me doing everything but testifying against the whole world. I said, wow. So the warden says, you know, you're in trouble. We got to lock you down. We got word from D.C. because I was a central monitoring inmate. And long story short, after that, something happened out of Chicago, and I had to make a choice whether I was going to renounce the life or not. And basically, I did. And people, I never expected it that it would shoot back to New York like a rocket. And when it did, all heck broke loose in my life. My dad, you know, disowned me. He didn't know what I was going to do. The poor guy, you know, I put him in the middle of something. I felt very bad about it. You know, Persico was extremely upset with me. I was in real trouble. Feds came to me, Franzese, words all over the street, you're a dead man anyway. Cooperate with us. We'll put you in a witness protection program. People, I didn't want to do that. I wasn't looking to hurt anybody. I just wanted out of the life, you know. I made my decision, and there really was no turning back at that point. And so I do the 5 years. It was a tough 5 years. They put me through a lot of stuff. They gave my wife a hard time. I get out on parole. I'm out on parole for 13 months on the West Coast. Worst time of my life. Worst time of my life. I'm like a fish out of water, L.A. I couldn't get anything going. The feds are coming to me. Francis, there's people out here to hurt you. They put my name on a witness list of trials that were going on here. John Riggi and all these guys. Everybody thought I was going to testify. They really gave me a tough time. I couldn't put a house in my name, no utilities. It was a tough time. My wife, every time I walked out the door, they scared her so much, she thought I wasn't going to come back. We didn't have phones over there. I had a beeper. She would beep me every half an hour. I'd run to a pay phone. I'm okay. Don't worry about it. I mean, it was bad. I couldn't earn a living. Big shot mob guy, earned all this money on the street. I couldn't get anything going in L.A. After 13 months, one morning, I tell my wife, honey, I'm going to breakfast. I'm going to the bank. When I come back, I'll buy you breakfast. I go to the bank 5 minutes from my house. I walk out of the bank, 15 agents out there. Okay, they slapped the cuffs on me. It was so embarrassing. They thought I was robbing a bank because I knew everybody in there. They go in the bank. They leaned all my bank accounts. They took my car, drove my car away, went to my house with a search warrant, cleaned us out. Went into my wife's purse, took every penny out of there and told her, hey, this is racketeering money. We're indicting your husband again. You don't work. It's all his. She couldn't even buy milk for the kids. Cleaned her out. They're driving me down to the lockup, and they said, Francis, we're done with you. We don't want you to cooperate anymore. We're fed up with you. We're indicting you on new charges. We violated you on your parole today. Quote, you will never see the street again. That was it. They bring me down to MDCLA, ready to transport me back to Brooklyn in the morning where my case was. They throw me in that 6x8, and here's my situation. You know what? This is hard for me to say, but I want to be honest with you. They threw me in that cell, and I said, I'm done. It's all over. 37 years old. What did I do? I said, another racketeering case? They took all my money? I said, you can't beat these cases with money. Without it, forget it. You're not doing it with a public defender. They're complicated. They're tough. I said, my wife, this girl waited for me 5 years, 13 months on parole. We got 2 children now. She's got no money. They took everything from her. How is she going to wait for me now? I'm going to lose the girl I did all of this for. I said, I got nothing but enemies. They won't put me on the yard. I said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in this 6x8 cell. I'm done. And people, I want to tell you this. I have felt every emotion you can feel in life, from ecstasy right down to grief and everything in between. I've led a pretty full life. But by far, the worst emotion you could ever experience in your life is hopelessness. When you feel, some of you have felt it, and for those of you who haven't, I hope you never do. It is horrible. When you feel that you've lost everything that's dear to you, everything that meant anything to you is gone. You're in this deep, dark hole. There's nothing you can do to get yourself out. You totally lost control of your life. Everything is just black. It is the worst feeling in the world. I'll be honest with you. My heart was hurting so much that night. It was a physical pain. My head was pounding. I couldn't deal with it. Call me whatever, a coward, whatever. I was just so broken down that night because I thought I just blew everything, and everything that was dear to me was gone. Everything. And I was angry with God. I was angry. Why? Because I had accepted Christ, my mother-in-law, my wife. Accept Jesus. He'll forgive you your sins. Really? I want some of that. What do I have to do? I'm a sinner. Get on my knees. Say the prayer. Tell me what it is. Really feel it in my heart. Did I mean it? I don't know. It was self-serving. I wanted forgiveness. Of course, who doesn't want to be forgiven? But I remember my mother-in-law telling me, but Mike, you got to surrender your life to Jesus. What do you mean surrender, Ma? I couldn't process that. To me, that was wimpy. It wasn't manly. What do you mean? God helps those who help themselves. That's how I grew up. Italians, my grandmother told me that since I was a kid. That's what I thought. That's how I knew. I couldn't process the surrender part. But you know what, people? I have found out your acceptance of Christ is made whole in your surrender to Him. Because that's when He can work through you. When you don't do that, it's not full. It's not complete. So I'm angry with God. God, I married this girl. I walked away from the life. And look what you did to me. I blamed Him for everything. I'm laying on that cot. And I want to tell you this. I used to look down at people that committed suicide. I said, that's weak. How could you even think of something like that? I don't do it anymore. I wasn't suicidal that night, but I will be honest with you. I'll confess this. I wanted to lay my head on that pillow, close my eyes. I didn't want to wake up. That's how bad I felt. I was just done. Okay? I'm laying there. A prison guard walks by my cell. He looked in on me. He said, Francis, are you okay? I said, get away from me. Don't bother me. I don't want to see you guys tonight. Leave me alone. He left. He comes back about a minute later. I don't have that book here. And he takes a book, and he puts it through the slot on the door. It falls on the floor. Dump, right? I'm kind of gathering my head. I looked down. I saw it was a Bible. The Bible. I got mad. I don't want to read a Bible. I wanted like a bottle of Prozac or something. I don't want to read a Bible, right? And I'm looking down at that Bible. I'm not exaggerating, people. I'm looking down at it, and everything is building up in me. I'm getting so mad that it took me maybe less than a minute. I jumped off of that cot, picked up the Bible, and threw it against that cinder block wall as hard as I could. It's like everything came out of me. It took me about 30 seconds. I said, you know what? I got nothing but enemies tonight. It's only me and God in this cell. I believed in Him. I said, I don't need another enemy. And I picked up the book, and I'll never forget, until this moment, I've never seen God in a dream. And I've never heard Him speak to me audibly. I believe some people have that gift. I don't have that gift. But He does speak to my heart all the time now, because I do have this relationship with Him, and I do look for His advice in prayer, right? And I opened up the book, just opened it like this. Now, I had never read the book of Proverbs before. In Catholic school, you know, you don't really read the Bible. The priest reads it from the pulpit. You read the catechism. So I didn't really know my Bible. I open it up, and coincidentally, it opens up to Proverbs. Now, why was that important? Because I told you, I'm an analytical type of guy. I like things that make sense, that are smart. So I start reading Proverbs. And as I'm reading it, I'm going, wow, this is really intelligent. The wisdom that Solomon displayed. I don't care if you're Christian, Jew, whatever it is. Solomon is brilliant. You know, when God said to Solomon in the book of Kings, nobody before you will ever be as wise, and nobody after you will ever be as wise, as a reward for something Solomon didn't ask for, with the exception of Jesus, who had a little advantage. He was God, right? Nobody, I believe, was as brilliant as Solomon. And I'm reading it. It's really catching my attention. And all of a sudden, people, I hear a verse. I read a verse that just stops me cold. And I start to think. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 7. When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, even his enemies are at peace with him. Now, why did that verse mean something? I'll tell you why. It was almost like God was standing in front of me and he was saying, oh, Francis, big tough mob guy, you're laying on that cot before and you're blaming me for everything. Oh, you married that girl. Because I was mad at God. Oh, you married that girl. What a noble thing you did. Well, who did you marry her for? Oh, you left the life. Big guy. Well, who did you do that for? Did you do it for me or did you do it for you? Well, I didn't do it for God. I did it for me. And it was almost like he convicted me in that verse. And then in the next verse, he gave me hope because he said, if you would have done it for me, I'd have taken care of your enemies. And you know what? God speaks to us in different verses in the Bible in different ways according to our needs. You can read a verse in the Bible and 10 different times it'll mean 10 different things to you according to your needs at that point. That's a living book. God speaks through that book. And that's how I interpreted it that night, because he knew that's what I needed to hear. So what happens? It motivates me a little bit. I'm a little bit uplifted, and I start to read on. And I come to a verse, people, that's become the verse of my life. And I believe it should be the verse of every one of your lives. It all should start here. And then everything goes from there. Now I'm going to sign some books for you people. Well, actually, I'm not. We ran out of books, but we'll talk about that later at the church this afternoon. But people ask me to sign books. I've signed thousands of books in my life. The kids, I'll sign their T-shirts, whatever they want me to do, as long as I don't get in trouble with their parents, right? And I used to feel bad signing books. I said, man, this don't feel right. You know, my signature don't mean anything. It's a name on a piece of paper. But then God put it in my heart and said, you know what? Every time you sign, if you're feeling bad about it, you put this verse underneath. And that made me feel better because I want to bring your attention to it. You will not see my signature if this verse is underneath. That's my commitment to the Lord. Okay? Because I want to bring your attention to it. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all of your ways, acknowledge him, and he will. Not he can, not he might. He will make your path straight. Now, why do you think that verse meant so much to me that night? Because I didn't trust God. I was still trusting myself. But that's the night I challenged God. I said, God, did it once with Dad, second time with this life. I can't do it again. I'm beaten down. You got to show me. Well, here's what happens. The racketeering case fell apart. They never indicted me. I did get 4 years on my parole violation. I spent 35 months and 13 more days in prison, 29 months and 7 days in that hole, 6x8 cell, me and God. During that time, I read my Bible inside out and upside down. If you see my prison Bible, more in my notes on there than there is scripture. I know my Bible. I don't recite verses. I'm not that intelligent, but I know my Bible. And I'm really a New Testament guy. I love it, but I know the Bible. I had plenty of time to read. My wife sent me in over 400 books, starting with Chuck Colson's Born Again was the first Christian book I read. And then I had her sending me books in on all different faiths. I wanted to know everything. I searched, and I studied, and I read my Bible, and I compared things. I had a Sony Walkman on. I used to listen to Pastor Greg Laurie. I love Pastor Greg. That soothing voice, the way he interprets Scripture. People, I want to tell you this. Anything that brings you closer to the Lord, audio, video, reading, read it. Don't only read the Bible, because there's gifted people out there whose purpose in life is to bring you closer to the Lord. Soak it up, because the closer you get to the Lord, the closer he comes to you. And I'll tell you what. I gave it up. I said, God, you know what? I'm giving it up to you. You know why? I don't have any other choice. I have no other options. I don't know what to do. But you know what? Our God will take us when he is the last option. After we've exhausted everything, he'll take us. And I want to tell you this. I believe with all my heart until today that he saved my life in that cell. Because if I'm on the street, never accept him. Too much a product of that life, too much thinking I'm in control. I couldn't do it. He must have said, you know what? I hate to do this to you, my son, but this is the only way you're going to understand. It ain't about your father. It's not about that life, and it certainly isn't about you anymore. It's about me. I have a job for you, and I got to put you through basic training here tonight for the next 3 years. It took that long. So I come out. I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no idea. A speaker? People, the pastor that married us, I hardly know him. A good old boy from Tennessee. I love this man. He's retired now, Dr. Myron Taylor. My wife wanted to get him married in a Christian church. I said, hey, Christian, whatever you want, let's get married, right? So he marries us, and while I'm away, he's sending me books, he's sending me money. I told my wife, hey, why is this guy doing it? I don't even know this guy. Why is he sending me? She told me, hey, keep quiet. He loves the Lord, in turn, he loves you. He's got nothing to do with you. Just take the books and take the money. I said, okay, right? So I get out, and he says, Mike, you got an incredible story. He said, I want you to give your testimony, please, in front of the church. I said, testimony? I didn't even know what he was talking about. I thought you did that from a witness stand, right? I didn't know what he was talking about. Long story short, I can't even begin to tell you how this thing just started for me, this ministry. And, you know, being such an aggressive guy, I got out of prison, and I'm, like, kind of raring to go to how I'm going to get my life back in order. And things that I did just weren't working out. But this ministry, this speaking, started to work out. And finally, maybe 10 years ago, I said, God, I'm going to do something I've never been able to do in my life. I'm going to have tunnel vision. I'm going to focus on this because it seems to be working. You know, we can't outthink God. When people say, Mike, what do you plan for your ministry? I don't know. I take it one day at a time. I try to take the direction that I think God is putting in my heart, and I try to go that way. And that's how this ministry has been built, not with a big plan. I've written 4 books. I'm on my 5th. They're doing a movie about my life. People have been trying to do that for the last 20 years, and I've always said no because I didn't think it was the right thing to do. Recently, okay, in the last year or so, a wealthy group of Christians came to me. They just did a documentary on me. They said, Mike, we want this to go global. And they asked me about a movie based upon the book. And I said, you know, let's talk about it. And it ended up that they supported me, and we're going to do this movie. I've written the script. And I will tell you this. It's a mob movie because I'm about outreach. I want people to come in the door that never would have came in and heard about the Lord. So, yeah, it's a mob movie. But I promise you this. If God isn't honored in that movie, it'll never hit the screen because I won't allow it. Because anything I do has to be in furtherance of the purpose of my ministry. We've got to give honor to God in all that we do. I just finished doing a 2-hour special for the History Channel that's going to air in January or February. They're going to make a series in it, and I'm the host of the show. I'm going there tomorrow, actually, to talk about the promotion of it. And this past week, I just filmed another TV show that will be hitting the air early next year. These are opportunities that God has brought to me. I haven't sought them out, but they're coming to me, and I think it's part of the plan. I don't know. If they don't work, then they weren't part of the plan. But if they work, because you never know in this industry. But they seem to be moving in the right direction. And so that's the road that I'm on. And God did all of this because this is not what I wanted to do, people. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't take the credit for it. I'm just trying to follow the steps, put myself with good people that advise me in the right way. We talk about it, and we see if we move forward, if it's of God. And if it's not of God, it's going to fail. And that's how I look at it. Now, just to bring this point home, that when God has a plan and a purpose for you, nothing is going to get in the way. No mob, no nothing is going to get in the way. I want to drive that point home. My book, Blood Covenant. Guys, you want to read a mob story? It's a mob story. I don't sugarcoat anything. Ladies, it's a love story. It's a story about me and my wife and how we got together. And it's a story really about how God can transform a heart. And by the way, we ran out of these. But if anybody wants to buy it, you can buy the book. I will personally autograph it to you, and we will mail it to your house. We'll take care of the posters and everything else. You'll have it in 2 or 3 weeks. The movie's being based upon this. But read the inside cover. When I walked out of jail in 95, everybody predicted my death. Everybody. Life magazine. If he holds to what he has promised, will mark the first time a high-ranking member of the mafia will publicly walk away from his past. Ed McDonald, head of the Organized Crime Strike Force in Brooklyn. He was my prosecutor. He went on national TV in 95, and he said, quote, I wouldn't want to be in Michael Franzese's shoes. I don't think his life expectancy is very substantial. Ed was very diplomatic. Bernie Welsh, one of the agents involved with my dad and me and all this stuff, he followed Ed to the podium that day, and he got up there. He wasn't as diplomatic. He said, quote, Franzese will get whacked. I think you know what that means in that life. That was in 1995. I told you the night that I walked into that room, Halloween night, 1975, 6 of us took the oath. I'm the only one alive today. Not one of those men died of natural causes. Wow. Little more proof. You saw the Fortune magazine article written in 1987, 50 biggest and most powerful mob bosses in the country. They actually had a chart. It was a huge article. They actually had a chart with the 50 of us on there, a list. And they listed us in rank and order. I was number 18, five behind Gotti. Don't ask me how they make a ridiculous list like that. They didn't ask for my tax returns. It's silly stuff, but it sold magazines. Not important. But here's what's important about that. Out of that list of 50, some 20-odd years later, 44 of them are dead. Three of them that I know of are doing life in prison without parole. And I'm here to talk to you about my Lord and Savior and my hero in life, Jesus Christ. So what that tells you all is this, people. When God has a plan and a purpose for you, nothing is going to stand in the way. No street life, no mob, no sickness, no death. The only thing that will stand in the way of God's fulfilling a purpose in your life is you. Because our God is never an intruder. He's always an invited guest. And all I can say to you at this point in time, this was all to make you understand that. That people, I will say this, I'm the most blessed guy, and I'll tell you what, struggles all the time. Remember this, God never promised us heaven on earth. He promised us heaven in heaven. But what he did promise us is that he would be behind us in all of our struggles. He would have our back, a very powerful thing to say on the street, to have your back. And I have found that to be true in my life. This year was one of the most difficult years I've had since I walked out of prison. It's been a tough, struggling year, and it hasn't been easy. And I had a little bit of sickness. I walked into the doctor, and he said, "Are you okay? Do you have a lot of stress?" I said, "Sir, I wouldn't know what life is without stress." I said, "It's normal to me." I said, "As a matter of fact, if it went the other way, I don't know how I'd handle it." But this is life. You know, God never promised us perfection. He never promised any of that. And, you know, for those of you that are Christians, you know, we Christians get a bad knock on us. As soon as we make a mistake, "Oh, he's a phony, he's a hypocrite, he's this and that." And you can judge me like that because I still make mistakes. I still sin. I'm a lot better, I think, than I was before, but I still sin. You know, there's an old saying, you don't get a lobotomy when you come to Christ. And you can take the boy out of Brooklyn, but you can't take Brooklyn out of the boy. I come back here, somebody wrongs me wrong. I say, "Hey, what's up, man? You know, I'm ready to go." Okay? It happens. But we are better. And you know what the sign of a real Christian is? When we do make a mistake, we get on our knees, we feel bad, and we say, "God, we did it. I did it again. Please forgive me for this." And you go on and you do better. Am I right, Ray? You do better because God helps you to do better, and you become a better person in that regard. So don't ever get down on yourself. So I'm going to ask Ray to come up, and I'm going to encourage you, people. If God is not in your life and you don't have this relationship with Jesus, it's never too late to start. And remember, you're not guaranteed another minute. So I advise, encourage, start tonight. Thank you.